Every Thursday afternoon, we check in on a, well, it's a very busy Thursday. Everything's busy these days. Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star, he's always busy. Zach joins us here on a Thursday afternoon. Long time, no talk. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm pretty good. How about you, Glass?
You're busy. I can tell in the tone of your voice because things this afternoon have been cascading. Number one, Indiana University. Hey, picked up a football commitment. Okay, we thought that'd be the big news of the day. Boy, were we wrong.
To be honest with you, I've been on vacation. I missed the football commitment, but
oh, it's an offensive lineman from Riverside, California.
Junior college player. Yeah. I think they officially sort of announced him. I think he'd committed, and they were
correct.
Finally able to sign him and announce him.
But he is on campus working out and has the grant and aid or whatever you officially get saying you're on scholarship. So now they can officially talk about him. We've talked about him, but again, we try to fill these holes in these summer days with information like this, and we think, okay, that'll get us through. That's great. And as the great Lee Corso has said oftentimes before, not so fast, my friends. Where do you want to start? We have to start in the Big Ten, don't we? They've had their official statement. What's going to happen this fall for sports programs?
Yeah, so the Big Ten, this has been building for a little while, and obviously football, as it always is, was kind of at the center of the reporting on this, but my sense was that coaches across the conference had been expecting this news. They're moving, at very least, their fall sports calendar, if there is a fall sports calendar, of course, to conference-only play. And that's not just football, though, of course, football will be the biggest one impacted by that. I think the expectation is that it will be a 10-game conference season. People have asked everything from what happens to the non-conference games in terms of contracts and, you know, potential rescheduling. What does this mean for bowl eligibility? How will the schedules be drawn out? Will they essentially be the schedules, the nine-game schedules that were already on the table, and then just a 10th game added on somewhere? The answer to those questions at this point is somewhere between I'm not sure and I just outright don't know. And I think the truth is that that's probably the case for a lot of athletics departments in the conference in some cases as well. But the decision itself was kind of the first thing that had to happen, and now it's on the table.
And that decision is just like everything else we're dealing with in society. It's coming in stages. You're not going to come out and say, okay, everything's canceled. We'll work our way back from there. It seems like the ACC today, they said, we're not doing any fall sports until September 1st. So it looks like we're trying to create some time and space here, just hoping to push back, instead of rushing out and saying, spring starts everything. We're trying to make this work. And we just have to be flexible, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that the attitude has long been, and I think that's been underscored in some of the national reporting. I'll shout out some people. Nicole Auerbach at The Athletic, Brett McMurphy at Watch Stadium, Ross Dellinger has done a great job of this at Sports Illustrated. I think this has kind of been the case even going back to the spring, but those people, those national folks that have been covering this in kind of a more of a 10,000-foot way, have really kind of reemphasized it in the last couple of weeks, going to the spring in terms of pushing fall sports to the spring. And I guess at some point, potentially winter sports to the spring is kind of a last resort. I think for the logistical challenges, for not knowing what that would do to your TV contracts, for not understanding what that would do to your bottom line and so forth. It's certainly preferable, of course, to no sports at all, but it's always been kind of the break glass in case of emergency situation, on the hope that at very least, if the worst comes to pass, by the spring we'll have a better handle on COVID-19 with regard to therapeutic options and also obviously vaccines. But you're right, everyone is trying to figure out ways to make this work, and as we speak I'm literally writing a story while I'm on with you, basically saying a lot of what I'm about to tell you or a lot of what we're about to discuss.
Ooh, breaking news. I like it. Thank you.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about breaking news, maybe more breaking analysis, so to speak. But, you know, this is everybody, as you said, trying to remain fluid, trying to think outside the box. And at some level, and this may sound craven, but trying to do what's best for them. And I know that sounds bad. This decision puts the screws to a lot of smaller athletics departments that were already in a really perilous financial position to begin with. But nevertheless, it's everybody trying to make the best. To reiterate the phrase that I've used many times on this show, Glass, it is the best of a bunch of bad options. And I think you've seen reporting that suggests the ACC may follow suit on this. The Pac-12 likely will follow suit on this. It raises all sorts of questions, again, for the Group of Five schools, for the FCS schools. Raises questions for a school like Notre Dame or Navy. Well, I guess Navy's actually in the American Athletic Conference now, but certainly Notre Dame, which counts on the Big Ten and the Pac-12 for a number of rivalry games every year, I think was also, I believe, supposed to face Wisconsin this upcoming season. But this is just kind of where we are. And I think that the biggest thing, you know, the kind of hook of what I'm writing is essentially that, yes, this is self-interested. Yes, it threatens to deepen these sort of financial challenges that the smaller schools are already facing. Yes, it could even signal kind of a very significant power realignment in college athletics. It was also the only realistic way to potentially get this done. For reasons that I imagine we can discuss.
Yeah. Does this show the dysfunction of college athletics here because you have conferences making their own independent decisions?
Here's the problem. Here's why this is the only way this works. We've talked about this many times. There are so many stakeholders involved in this process, and it is virtually impossible to bring them all under one roof. The NCAA, in theory, could be that sort of clearinghouse that has one arm that speaks to the state legislatures, the state public health departments, the sort of governmental entities and public health entities behind all this. Another arm that speaks with the conferences and keeps them kind of all in lockstep. Another arm that addresses the concerns of the individual schools, their presidents, their chancellors, their campus safety officers or task forces, whatever. But I think the reality is that we've come to a place now where the NCAA doesn't necessarily have that power in a sort of, omnipresent way. We've seen the Power Five schools start to kind of collect more power over the last 10 to 15 years, certainly financial power. You think back to realignment when the NCAA didn't necessarily say don't do this, but definitely wasn't encouraging it. And the Power Five conferences said, oh, well, we're still going to do it. It's often been up to the individual conferences to hand down, or at least it's the better way to put it is it's been up to the individual conferences to lead the way on things like cost of attendance scholarships and, you know, student athlete welfare. Not always. The NCAA is, but the conferences have, over the last 10 to 15 years, positioned themselves to be the real sort of power centers in college athletics. And now you have this problem, which is how do you get all these, the conferences alone can't bring all those stakeholders together. There has to be one independent or one sort of, you know, top of the pyramid organization that does that, but it's not going to be the NCAA. And so what you're seeing instead is the conferences at very least sectioning themselves off and saying, well, listen, this may not be doable anyway, but what we can at least do is act as one body together. The Big Ten already has a coronavirus task force that is staffed by medical experts from around the conference. It can use that to create blanket conference procedures when it comes to anything it wants to that it can get its schools to agree to, from testing to tracing to saying, you know, what's the cutoff point at which you can't compete? If you have X number of positives, if you have 3 positives, is that too many? Or does it have to be 10? Or is it a percentage of your team?
Well, and I think that's the greater.
And at very least, you can't create a bubble, but you can at very least kind of create an umbrella. That might be the best way to put it. You can create an umbrella that your conference, it covers your conference. Nobody's leaving it. Does it keep everybody perfectly dry? No. Will it work in the end? Maybe not. If the rain is coming down too hard and the wind is whipping too fast, then it won't work. But it at least gives you the chance to keep everybody dry enough to make this work. And that's where everyone is.
And the conferences are doing this because they aren't going to be told by anybody else to do that, because as you just drew the picture, there's nobody else to tell them. And the other side of the coin is, the Big Ten can do whatever it wants because they won't face retribution from anybody, regardless of the direction they decide to take. If they said, "Hey, look, we're gonna play our football schedule this way," there's not, stop that, you can't do that. Well, there isn't that to happen. So these conferences are turning into islands a little bit. I mean, I guess you have the Power Five, which suggests that they're all in the same boat financially and want to make sure that the television revenue is still there. But they kind of can do anything they want. They don't have anyone to answer to.
Right, and that's where it comes back to the idea that, yes, it's self-interested. But, you know, if you're Kevin Warren, obviously the commissioner of the Big Ten, and what a time to be in your first year as commissioner of the Big Ten, you know, your constituency is your broad constituency is college athletics, but your specific constituency is your schools and your schools' athletics departments. And, you know, you could get someone from a Ball State that might say, well, if we don't get the guarantees, when, you know, coupled with the loss in school funding that we're facing, this could be just absolute financial Armageddon for us. But somebody like Kevin Warren, I think, would be fair in replying, well, listen, if this all completely falls apart, then, you know, if we're not here to pay those guarantees 2 or 3 years from now, then what good is this anyway? I'm not saying that this is the perfect decision or that it's a virtuous decision. I'm not denying there's an element of self-interest to it. But I also just, you know, this is just a time where there's no good decision. There's only best bad ones.
Zach,
and this is a best bad choice.
Zach, and I laugh because that phrase makes sense. It clears up anything that would confuse somebody. Zach Osterman from the Indy Star is our guest this afternoon. He's in with us every Thursday. And yesterday, the reality of the situation was seeing Stanford cut 11 of 36 sports. And we can talk about what sports those are and how do they matter or not. That's not the point. The point is, you would think when you hear the word Stanford, you think of an institution of higher learning, number one. And number two, deep pockets that win these Sears Directors titles every year for the great athletic programs they have. They just showed you how reality is getting very real in their realm.
Yeah, it's funny that story specifically. I think that a bit of the buried information was that apparently Stanford was sponsoring 36 varsity sports.
36.
That's quite a lot. But yeah, it does speak to the idea that there's nobody's safe from this. You know, I mean, Indiana's best case budget scenario involved having to cut almost $12 million off of its 2020-2021 budget. I mean, that, you know, and that's a best case scenario, $12 million. And that's a best case scenario. I will say that over and over again until people understand it. This isn't, you know, this isn't about waterfalls and locker rooms and extravagant spending on assistant coaching salaries. Like we're talking about, you know, organs here. You know, we're talking about hearts and lungs and kidneys and, you know, livers of athletics departments. I know that's a weird metaphor, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. Like we're talking about the absolute, you know, meat and bones of athletics departments being threatened. And, you know, again, you talk about the ways in which a school like Indiana might be slightly more insulated than some other schools. Well, there's another example. Indiana's only got 24 varsity sports, hasn't added one in years, and has been petitioned to add them all the time.
If you don't think that Indiana isn't
petitioned to add varsity sports, rugby,
lacrosse,
hockey,
beach volleyball, I've heard.
Yeah. I mean, even going so far as like varsity cycling, trust me, that stuff gets brought up all the time. And Indiana has for years just completely and totally declined, never explored to my knowledge, never genuinely considered, none of it. And so now Indiana is in a position where that fiscal responsibility has at least left it a little bit more fortified against this stuff than most. But I come back to those numbers we've discussed before. Nearly 38% of Indiana's revenues last fiscal year came straight from football. Nearly 38%. We're not talking about, again, luxury spending, getting people into trouble. You know, this isn't, you know, you getting an unexpected raise and going out and buying, you know, three nice sports cars and then not being able to make the payments on them when that raise goes away. We're talking about, like, what happens if a company loses half its revenue one day? It just disappears. And so, again, I say, yes, this absolutely puts the screws to smaller schools. You know, I think Ball State had two or three Big Ten teams on its schedule this year. I think Indiana was reported to owe Western Kentucky something like $1 million for the two games that it was going to play, face Western Kentucky here or something like that. But, you know, it just, I mean, it's cliche, but drastic times. And what this allows the Big Ten to do, among other things, if there is a fall sports calendar at any point, even if potentially it goes into the winter or even the spring, well, if you play 10 conference games, guess what? You can charge a little bit more money to the TV networks because you're handing them conference games and conference games only. So then what happens if the TV networks say, oh, well, we like that. Maybe when this all goes back to normal, we go to 10 conference games or even 11 or even 12. You know, what if we do away with divisions, but we find some other format? I don't know. I'm just making this up.
Yeah, everything's on the table.
You know, this is where the sort of seismic long-term change comes.
And that's a seismic change because you just wiped out.
Trying to survive.
Right, but you just wiped out. In your plan, you wiped out all Ball States in the MAC, and you wiped out all of those other non-Power 5 schools. If it's almost like the super leagues they want to do in Europe for soccer. If you wipe out all this other stuff, they will go away because so many of those departments are funded by taking your 72-3 beating at Ohio State on the first Saturday in September. You get your $2 million.
What happens if Ohio State's not there to pay you for that in 3 years?
Exactly.
And maybe the Big Ten decides to make it permanent, says, you know what, no more guarantee games.
That's what you wipe out. Yeah, you wipe out a bunch of.
But for now, the Big Ten is like everybody else. They're just trying to survive.
And you can't read you can't read between the lines right now about any long-term plans or anything else because there probably are plenty of long-term plans. There probably have plenty of binders on the shelf right now because we haven't had a whole lot to do the last 90 days. But that doesn't mean those plans will be activated. And why didn't this happen last week? Why didn't this happen the week before? Again, they're just trying to put this off as long as possible. Is that the best way to look at it?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, everybody's just trying to push this down as – I want to say push it down the road because that makes it sound like they're not addressing it. They're trying to go as far – as they can, as close as they can to the season before they realistically have to cut, you know, make some really difficult decisions in the hope that maybe something changes or they, you know, that they come up with methods that can allow them to try different things. It's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult. It's not perfect at all. But it's, like I said, it's kind of the best that anybody can do right now.
And we're not even talking about COVID testing on campus or sports programs. That we haven't got to that part yet because that's going to tell us a lot more than these plans going forward. I think the other game that was canceled yesterday was Northwestern Wisconsin at Wrigley Field. That they already said, nah, we're good. We're not going to go to – so I guess that game moves back to campus if they have a game there. So all these little pieces of the puzzle have been moving along. The question I'll have for you when we come back after the break is the Ivy League was the first to shut down their postseason tournament in basketball, and everybody followed suit there. Are they leading by choice, default, or is it nice to have somebody go first so no one points the finger at you and said, you screwed it up and do that? We'll ask that of Zach Osterman. We'll also talk about some bowl spending. Novak and I saw John Blau's story pop in our show yesterday. And I want to get your thoughts on the – I don't want to say the commenters on Twitter or the stories, But I want you, as a football guy who knows finance, to tell me why $44,000 loss, after all we just talked about, why that is a good thing as opposed to a bad thing, or maybe I'm wrong, I think it's a good thing, of how bowls work, how the conference payouts work, and why you want to be involved in that conversation. We'll let Zach catch his breath and bang out a couple paragraphs. We'll take a break with IU Credit Union and do a sneak in some Network Indiana news, and we'll come back with the beat writer for Indiana football and basketball for the Indy Star, Zach Osterman, next. All right. As we move along on a Thursday afternoon, the big story this week, today, the Big Ten Conference, for their fall sports schedule, according to an official release from the conference, the Big Ten announced today, and I want to read this carefully so you can hear one special word in this box. The Big Ten Conference announced today that if the conference is able to participate in fall sports, and they've listed them all there, conference-only schedules in all sports. Details for these sports will be released at a later date, while decisions on sports not listed above will continue to be evaluated. I would read that as winter and spring sports. The Big Ten's rationale is this: by limiting competition to other Big Ten institutions, the conference will have the greatest flexibility to adjust its own operations throughout the season and make quick decisions in real time based on the most current evolving medical advice and the fluid nature of the pandemic. I will add to that as well. If they have, as Zach Osterman has mentioned, they have a task force they have put together. They do not have to worry about what Western Kentucky is doing. They do not have to worry about what Northern Illinois is doing. They don't have to worry about what, fill in the blank, whoever's on these non-conference schedules, or any of these schedules for all of these fall sports where you have to go everywhere to every corner and you play in this classic and that class. You don't know what they're doing, and you don't know perhaps what the local rules and regulations are. So this does make some sense. It's protective, it's proactive, and obviously the first thing people will circle is the football schedule and say, that means conference games only. Well, for now, it does. Zach Osterman is the beat writer for the Indianapolis Star. A lot to chew on here today. I thought you did a good job in our first segment explaining all of that. Now that we get back into, I don't know, reality, how tough is it to have the bowl budget story come out when we've got all of this other stuff happening? But the good news is Indiana wasn't a bowl last year. And is it a big deal to lose money at a bowl game? I thought they would lose a lot more money than that. Tell me how this finance works.
And this is another kind of this is another area wherein it's good to already be rich. And what I mean by that is the Big Ten has effectively set it up so that conference teams don't lose money on bowls. And the way they do that is they basically take everyone's bowl money, they put it into a giant pool that's all funneled through the conference. This has always been my understanding. And then they basically create a payout for each school based on what they will need for their bowl game. So, for example, a school like Indiana, Ohio State should and probably did make tons of money because schools are still taking in money in different ways, you know, ticket sales. I'm talking about bowl payments in particular, the money that you get from the bowl for playing in the bowl game. You know, schools can still make money on bowls, but then you have a situation where, for example, if you're the Big Ten, you send Indiana out to Santa Clara, California in 2016. Indiana should take a shower on the Foster Farms Bowl because you know it's not going to be able to sell a ton of tickets, and you know it's going to be hard for the school to market, and you know travel and lodging are both going to be very expensive because you're taking a team across country to the most expensive city in the United States, or certainly one of them in San Francisco. So what the Big Ten does is it builds in a contingency where basically it takes all the bowl money, pools it together, and then pays off whatever anyone needs. And so that's why you see maybe a school finishes $25,000 in the black off a bowl, or $45,000 as Indiana roughly did in the red. But generally speaking, the nobody's going to wind up coming out of a bowl game down $900,000 in the Big Ten. And that's because of the way the Big Ten structures it. Of course, the smaller conferences don't have that opportunity. This you know, because they're not in bowl games that are paying that much money. The conferences themselves aren't bringing in that much money. You just don't have the it's not realistic in the same way. You know, just because of the finances of it. So from Indiana's perspective, okay, you lose $45,000 on what was expected to be about a $130 million budget. You can cover that in other ways. And of course, it's not a good year to have, you know, revenues less expenses in the red in any case. But nevertheless, the issues when you get into, you know, I think a few years ago, UConn, when they played in the BC, the what was that? I think it may have been the Fiesta Bowl. I think it was something to the effect of like $8 million. I'd have to go and look it up. But UConn lost huge money. And it was because they weren't, you know, they didn't have a fan base, even as excited as it might have been to be playing in a BCS bowl, that was going to be able to move the tickets and buy the merchandise and engage with the bowl in a way that was going to make them the money back that they would need to spend on traveling there, playing in it, blah, 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 blah. And so that's where you can really get in some financial difficulty with the bowls if you're not careful. But the Big Ten schools, by my understanding of the way the system is set up, have always been kind of protected from that. So
have they done that to protect them from themselves? Are there schools in the SEC that do this? Obviously, the Big Ten and SEC get compared a lot across the board, but do they have that same, I don't know, parachute? Is that the right word I'm using here?
I mean, I think it's – the Big Ten has always been somewhat equitable, frankly, in the way that it did things. You know, that it doesn't stagger TV payments by size of department or, you know, like one of the big sticking points, for example, in conference realignment was that a lot of Big 12 schools felt that that Texas and I think to some extent Oklahoma were getting really favorable terms from, you know, the conference's broadcast revenue deals. The Big Ten has always done equal shares on those things. And that's always just kind of been the Big Ten's way. And so I think a lot of it really just frankly comes down to more just the conference's approach to saying there are going to be certain things that we're going to keep equitable so that we don't have a huge stratification of haves and have-nots in the conference. And that doesn't mean that the Big Ten can solve the gap between Indiana football and Ohio State football, of course, but it means that Ohio State's success will to some extent always be Indiana's success. And to the same, to kind of the to a sort of extended degree, when you talk about Indiana and Ohio State both going to bowl games, both Indiana and Ohio State can go to those bowl games safe in the knowledge that, A, there will be bowl revenue for everybody at the end of the year, because there is still money made on top of bowl expenses across the entire conference. It's just allocated and distributed differently. And B, nobody's ever, like I said, going to have to take a shower on, you know,
success.
Illinois.
Yeah.
Losing $1 million just to play in a bowl game. Illinois doesn't choose to go to the Foster Farms Bowl. You know, that's a big part of this too. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this in many different ways down the years. The conferences anymore essentially tell the schools where they're going when it comes. The schools can politic somewhat. And of course there are rules built into the bowl contracts that say, well, we can't take a certain number of teams back over a certain period of years and things like that. So if you play in, let's say, the Penn State Bowl, you probably won't go back again anytime soon, at least until the current contract expires. But one way or another, Illinois is not choosing to go to the Foster Farms Bowl. Indiana's not necessarily choosing to go to the Gator Bowl. Minnesota's not choosing to go to the Outback Bowl. They are falling into a bowl structure that the conference, the bowls, and the TV networks have negotiated together.
And the payoff to the schools are they stay above water and don't take a bath on it. So that's kind of a fair shake when you think about it.
Exactly.
Now, the other part of this I find fascinating, because I don't know it, all schools get bowl revenue money regardless if you're in a bowl game?
Yes, but I believe you get more.
Obviously,
and
if you participate.
I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but there is still financial incentive to making a bowl beyond simply having your bowl trip paid for. But even if you don't make a bowl, you will still feel some of the financial success of someone else making a bowl.
Well, then that does make sense. So it's the rising tide floats all boats to a degree. So the conference shines, and obviously with the conference's footprint and how many bowl games they get a year, that should be okay. So when Indiana goes to the bowl game, and John Blau did a great job of itemizing the report and showing you all this, my favorite line in his entire story, and I know John, you didn't write this, John did, but he said essentially it cost you $44,000 to have you be the only game in town on TV against an SEC foe in a game after New Year's Day. That's a pretty good deal. That's a great deal.
Yeah, for less than, yeah, you, no, absolutely. For less than $50,000, Indiana gets 3.5 hours of primetime viewing with no other games on what was it, the night of January 2nd, and what turns out, I know Indiana loses, but what turns out to be a very exciting bowl game.
For the neutral,
yeah. Pretty good ratings share, and you can, you know, your coaches will be able to, I mean, I don't think you could swing a dead cat through the IU football facilities when people were still in them and not hit a coach wearing Gator Bowl branded IU gear. And of course that's the way this works. And if you're going to go into a recruit's home, you're going to wear the IU gear in the recruit's home. If you're going to go and speak at a, you know, a coaching clinic, you're going to wear it at the coaching clinic. You're going to let people know you were in it. So that appearance continues to work for you on into the future. Yeah. For $50,000, that's not really bad at all. Now, of course there are other costs. Indiana had to give Tom Allen a big new contract. It had to pay out. I'd have to go back and look at my numbers, but I want to say something in excess of like $750,000 in bonuses last season. It had to up the contractual terms for a number of its assistants this year. But one way or the other, that's part of the understanding you have of the cost of success. And I think you can just roll again about $45,000 in revenue lost, or however you want to say it, you know, profit loss on the actual bowl game trip itself into that as well.
And it sounds contrite in this day and age, but when all this took place, it was a different day and a different age. So let's not weave a basket out of pure gold strands here. Where that's not what we're doing, or we're just trying to explain to people why these things happen and how they happen. And you have to kind of separate the myth from reality, because a lot of this, the money we're talking about from the TV and everything else, isn't real money in the sense it's completely ridiculous. Can this pattern continue through televised sports?
Well, in what way?
See, that's the hard part, because will a handful of games be enough? Do you need to have 12 games to be enough? Is 9 conference games enough? I know you don't have this answer, but just from, you've looked at the numbers so many times, how important is it to just have the 9 conference games as opposed to 12 total games? Can you get by on that?
I think the hope is you can. I think there's also an understanding that even if you play the season, you may not play a full schedule. You know, you may wind up in a situation where you have to cancel 2 weeks of games that may not be made up. But I think you try. I think you do your best. And, you know, I think you can certainly renegotiate some terms with television contracts and advertisers. Say, for example, if, you know, if Michigan and Ohio State are playing in an empty stadium, well, you know, given the fact that nobody's going to games and everybody's locked down and nobody's got anything to do, we're confident you're going to get a bigger market share. You're going to get a bigger audience.
Yeah.
Bigger
well,
television audience. Now, we you can just make more money. We can charge more for advertising. We can find different ways to monetize it. And then as you go forward again, maybe we get out of this and the TV networks come back and say, you know, we actually really like 10 conference games. Maybe the Big Ten Network people come back and say, you know, we'll be honest with you. We were even for the lesser sports, even for the soccers and the volleyballs and, you know, the wrestlings and the baseballs, we were getting way better numbers when we were just showing conference games and nothing else than when we had, you know, an entire portion of the seasonal sports calendar that was just non-conference.
Let me give you a. I've got a weird idea. I just thought of it because you make me think in different ways. You have divisions in football, the National Football League, and you play home and away. Do they go to that model? Because wouldn't Ohio State versus Michigan twice be a lot better than only once?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do worry about oversaturation at a point. And I think, you know, I mean, listen, I've argued against it. I'm firmly in the camp that says the playoff should stay where it is at four schools. It's not going to. I think everyone understands that. The playoff is going to move to eight, maybe even 16 at some point. I think there's a danger in making college football too much like the NFL, because I think that part of the appeal of college football has always been that, well, it's the same sport. It has its own rivalries, its own pageantry, its own romantic kind of ideals, if you will, and that there's appeal in on Saturday being able to watch a game knowing that if one team loses, you know, their greatest ambition for the season is going to evaporate. And then on the Sunday, watch and say, well, okay, one team can win and one team can lose because they can still both make the playoffs. I think there's just value in those two products being distinct. And so I think that, you know, I would think college would be wary of moving too far toward an NFL model. And then I think you'd also potentially get into, you know, some serious conversations again. And I think they're going to be unavoidable in the near future anyway, overpaying players and things like that. But one way or another, I do think you're going to come out the other side of this, and you're going to see more interest from broadcast partners and people like that. Assuming these seasons do happen, in maybe cutting down on some of the non-conference stuff, you know, going heavier on the conference games, finding ways to create more of those marquee matchups. And I don't know if that's good or it's bad, but I think that's where we might wind up.
What do you think moving forward? Because I don't, did anybody expect this announcement today or this part of July? What's the next announcement going to be? Do we get into fall camp, or do we even risk getting to that point?
Well, I think everyone's going to kind of try to continue a pace for the moment. You know, obviously you've seen individual schools have to pause workouts in different programs because of positive tests. Louisville basketball had to do it, I think, just earlier this week. I've been on vacation for some of this week, so there may be other examples I've missed. But
North Carolina football had a bunch of players test.
Yeah, okay, that one, I saw that too.
I can't get anything past you. What do you mean you're on vacation? Come on.
Well, I know I'd forgotten until you mentioned it. But, you know, again, I think that, you know, I feel like end of this month, maybe early August. I don't know that we can push it much further than that, because at some point you've got to give the schools and the programs the high sign, and not just football, but all of them the high sign on whether to say, okay, you can enter a full preseason where you're doing full contact, you're in pads, or, you know, you're on the court or you're on the field or whatever. Or you have to say, listen, it's not realistic for us to start on time, and so we're not going to be putting athletes in potentially hazardous situations in the meantime. So everybody's got to take a breath. I think it's probably end of this month, early next month.
Yeah, because it makes like no sense to deadline. Yeah, it makes no sense to bring everybody on campus to tell them to stop training. Or you can't, or, you know, there's right. There's no point where there's going to be a minimal schedule, or if there are no sports in general, that's a whole another enchilada for a whole different sort of meal. Zach Osterman's our guest today. We will have baseball for you on Friday. We hope it is the penultimate Reds Classic. We'll take you back to 1988 September as Tom Browning throws the 12th perfect game in the history of Major League Baseball, blanking the Dodgers 1-0. 100 pitches, 72 were strikes, and we'll have the gang there for the first time. And is baseball going to get started? Who do we look to for guidance? Are we looking to the MLS bubble, the NBA bubble? Is there something that's going to stick out that is just going to push everything over and say, this is either why it's going to happen or why it's not going to happen?
I just wear a mask.
Yeah, start there.
Wear a mask, wash your hands, socially distance. You know, one of the things that has done my head in, and we've all, and I don't want to sound over the top, we've all been frustrated. We've all been saddened by what's been going on, and it's taking us all out of our normal routines and taking things away from, you know, from our lives that, that we hold valuable. I mean, please understand, I'm not saying this is a sob story. I know there are literally thousands of people in the exact same place I am. I haven't seen my mother in four months, you know, except on video calls.
That's very real.
And so one of the things that has done my head in more than anything else is what is, I'm sure, a small, loud, obnoxious minority on Twitter saying that the media is pulling for there to be no college football season.
We want to be unemployed
for political reasons, or so we could say we told you so, or I'm not even really sure why. Like, yeah, I mean, this is literally my job. In addition to being like a job that I consider a passion, of course, it is literally the thing that pays my mortgage and puts food on my table and turns the water on in my house. And if you want those things, I mean, I want those things. I think we all want those things. Of course, we want them as normal as possible. But even if we can't get them back as normal as possible, we want to do whatever we can to have them back in whatever form we can. If you want that, wash your hands, wear a mask, socially distance.
Not hard.
Don't go to parties. Don't go to the pool. Don't, you know, like, just be smart. Go walking in the park. I mean, the number of times, I mean, you know, I my son and I drove around yesterday hunting out abandoned playgrounds so that we could find one that he could play on by himself. And so we didn't have to worry about it, but he could still have that time to, you know, be two and run around and go down slides and whatever else. We're all having to adapt. We're all having to adjust. And yes, it sucks. But I promise you it's going to suck worse when it comes to for those of us that really value college sports, high school sports, to some extent, frankly, probably even pro sports in this country. And it's worth pointing out, other countries are making this work. But that's because there's more widespread buy-in for people to be able to just say, I'll wear a mask, I'll wash my hands, I'll socially distance wherever possible, and I will be responsible not just for myself, but for the benefit of others as well.
Well said, my friend. We always appreciate your time and your insight. You make us think, and that's what makes it great. We'll let you get back to your writing. Sorry about your hour break there. But we'll see you soon, and join us next week, and we'll see where we are next week. It's never a dull moment.
Thanks for having me, as always, Glass.